This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz. New Zealanders Randall and Gail Lockie of Rothesay Bay treasure their friendships from when they worked surrounded by a new culture overseas. Randall Lockie's book, adapted for broadcast on our program Historic Souvenirs, shares their memory.
The Papua New Guinea Expatriate Experience. Newsletters from Port Moresby.
Free FM 89.0 is proudly supported by New Zealand On Air. There's chaos communicating with our various destinations where our Air New Guinea flights go. Sometimes it's simple and straightforward, contacting the staff at any of 19 airports, conveying our airline's passengers and cargo to Papua New Guinea. Faced with frustrating breakdowns in our links, we do our utmost to go through other offices to get our messages through. For example, we need ask urgently about concerns over Air New Guinea's office in the Admiralty Islands, far to the north of our headquarters in Port Moresby. I dial the direct number listed in our company's internal phone directory. No response. So I ring our radio room, requesting they call up our office there on Manus Island, which lies close to the equator. The island, previously in the German Empire, then British, briefly held by Japan, before becoming a United Nations Trust Territory of Australia. Doubts shroud the history as to who from Europe is first to land on this volcanic island. Settlers who follow find there are fortunes to be made exporting coffee, copra, cocoa, and timber. As people granted the right to independence in 1975, Manus Islanders opt to join the independent state of Papua New Guinea, a constitutional monarchy. Still no radio response to our headquarters efforts to raise Manus Island on our high-frequency, single sideband radio. Eventually they tell me about Port Moresby's transceiver having been unserviceable for the past 3 weeks. They advise me to ring our Air New Guinea office at Lae so they can call up on their high-frequency single-sideband radio. Alas, the Lae office declares its radio down, but they believe our office in Kau Vieng in New Ireland may help. They do. The manager tries on my behalf whilst I'm waiting on hold. Manus is not responding, so the manager offers to try raising Manus in the morning. This is how exasperating it gets doing business in Papua New Guinea. Yet, life goes on in the balmy tropics, regardless of Westerners' frustration at delay and perceived inefficiency. Combined high humidity and heat leaves us breathless outdoors. Almost a pleasure to be based in an office with the benefits of air conditioning. We'll sigh with relief once the rains come to cool us from hot, searing sunshine. Another occasion, we fly on a 44-seat twin turboprop Air New Guinea Fokker Friendship. The flight path to Rabaul in New Britain puts us on a course over the Owen Stanley Ranges. Within minutes of takeoff from Port Moresby, our F-27 Friendship enters the Kokoda Gap. the gap rising to an elevation of 2,000 feet with a width of roughly 11 miles is a natural flight path for aircraft. Looking down, we see its challenge to trampers who face a tough time picking their way single file along its track. Its terrain favours guerrilla warfare. Below, the foot track rises high to cross the range, freezing at night, burning by day. The historic trail is almost 100 kilometres long. Here is as close as the Japanese come to menacing Australia in World War II, with its planning to invade Australia, then New Zealand, once Japan gets a firm grip on Papua New Guinea. Here is where Japanese ambitions falter. It's called the Kokoda Trail, passing through a region where scientists say vegetation grows 4,000 different species of plants, let alone its multitude of insects, many poisonous, and reptiles, mainly snakes. From 1942 to 1943, Japanese and Australian troops encounter each other. Many die. Once the war's over, Strategic Jungle Trail falls into neglect for a few years before becoming a tourist attraction. For Australians, it's a living memorial to all their fallen soldiers, as Gallipoli is to the fallen soldiers of the First World War. Now, in peacetime, thousands will walk Kokoda Trail every year. From the aircraft, we can pick out several of the most hair-raising landing strips for light aircraft I've ever seen. Most appear on steep ridges or down in deep valleys. One extreme airstrip is so short, pilots rely on gathering sufficient airspeed on the downward slope that the plane lurches off the end, plunging into the dive that gathers velocity to avoid stalling as it gains an airspeed to fly normally out from the valley and on to its destination. Here is the world's last surviving habitat of the world's largest butterfly, the Queen Alexandra birdwing, a butterfly discovered in 1906, an endangered species that lives nowhere outside tropical rainforest of Oro province. Only an orb-web spider and some small birds are known to eat this rare butterfly, which has a lifespan of about 4 to 5 weeks. The female is a huge, mostly brown butterfly with yellow and white markings and broad wings, her body being as much as 3 inches long, with a wingspan of almost 11 inches. I have no doubt that should one appear cruising at our altitude, a diversion would be called for. Incidentally, Papandetto also claims fame as the site of the world's biggest palm oil industries, Higaturu oil palms. From the air, my immediate impression is one of looking down upon the greatest game of dominoes, the tops of palms seeming like dots in long lines, lines stretching out in odd-shaped plantations, shapes for as far as the eye can see. From Papandetto we fly over the Solomon Sea, crossing the coast of New Britain, the largest island in the Bismarck Archipelago. Breathtaking scenery. From my vantage point, 5,000 feet up in the air, the tropical interior is unforgiving. Muddy brown rivers snake through the jungle, breaking the monotony. Volcanoes with giant lava flows move mysteriously down the rugged rock landscape. Does anyone live down there in this foreboding, little-known part of our planet? Making our approach to landing at the airport of Rabaul, our flight path curls around one dormant volcano and directly above the crater of another. The final descent rather abruptly brings Rabaul's harbour and Old Town into sharper focus. Slowing to taxi to the terminus, our plane passes nearby another volcano. No wonder Rabaul experiences tremors, so is often referred to as Volcano Town. This is Rabaul as it is in 1979, the most spectacular airstrip that I've had the pleasure of visiting. In 1994, its tropical charm is, with only 19 hours warning, devastated two volcanoes, Vulcan and Tavabu, often referred to as mother and daughter, erupt, coating Rabaul and its airport in volcanic ash so thick that buildings collapse under its weight. These same two mountains erupted in 1937, killing 507. Recognizing a risk of another caldera exploding, as happened many centuries ago, the government plans for the future by relocating 30 kilometres away the pretty tree-lined township of Old Rabaul, a safer location close to Kokomo, and 40 kilometres away to build a new airport for the same reason. Leaving the flight to New Britain at the old town of Rabaul, I greet our local area Air New Guinea manager, Tony Lavatul, who offers to take me into town to Hotel Kaibuna. My room is nothing fancy, yet fit for purpose. I can't help but notice, though, there's one way in and out of my room. Its ranch slider opens and closes, but its lock's broken. I ask Tony if he'll be my guest at the New Guinea Club. He's hesitant at first, as surprisingly he's not a member. Undoubtedly, the club had been a purely expatriate affair in its heyday. However, with a bit of encouragement, Tony says he'll come. Badly damaged in World War II, the club restores its premises only to be destined for another setback in 1993, when flames engulf the building. In the intervening years, some recall a young, confident, good-looking Australian actor, Errol Flynn, charming his way into the club with that swashbuckling panache that leads him to stardom as a Hollywood heartthrob in years to come.
When you reached out and touched me for the first time, I felt my heart had never beat before. You gave my life some meaning for the first time.
Our waiter is serving drinks to our table, accompanied by drink coasters, those small mats made to go under the drinking glasses, one for my guest, another for me. Their purpose is unfamiliar to Tony, who's from Papua New Guinea and has never come upon drink coasters. Mistaking it as food, he takes a bite before I can intervene, thinking it's a biscuit. It's cardboard. What fascinates me most about Rabaul is its history in New Britain Island. I had just finished reading a book by R.W. Robson about the legendary Queen Emma, who lived ostentatiously in what would have been in the late 19th century considered cannibal country. Queen Emma set up an impressive trading empire. I asked Tony if we might drive to Ralum, where she lived, close to Kokopo. Here she put on grandiose champagne parties. We discover this very spot of their celebration, the large regal outside staircase, just about all that remains of her former mansion. As I stand at the top of these stairs, I take in the panoramic views of Duke of York Islands of the Bismarck Archipelago. In these waters, empires rise and fall over the ages. Rabaul having been the German colonial headquarters till the British take over administering Papua New Guinea after World War I. The islands are then invaded by Japan in 1942. Under Admiral Yamamoto, Rabaul serves as Japan's Imperial High Command headquarters with the Admiral's office in the very New Guinea club premises where we socialized the other night. The Japanese had turned the headquarters into the most heavily defended target in the Southwest Pacific. No less than 367 anti-aircraft guns ring their imperial headquarters at Rabaul. Heavy naval engagements account for about 40 sunken wrecks in its Simpson Harbour, which is created by a caldera volcanic explosion long ago. There are also around the town over 500 kilometres of tunnels in which 97,000 Japanese troops stationed there shelter. I regard Rabaul as the most fascinating town in Papua New Guinea. At its heart, the harbour. The township spread around its shores. To think how different it might have been had Japan not attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. That's what brings United States forces into World War II, firmly on the Allies' side. Imagine how much worse it'd be if, rather than surrender, Japan kept 60,000 troops remaining at Rabaul fighting.
It's not what you can do for me that matters. Even though your love is pure and true, it's knowing that you care enough about me to reach into my heart and pull me through.
To reality, and time for me to reconfirm my onward travel plans en route to flying to Manus Island, where my problem-solving skills will be put to the test, it being the whole reason for my trip in the first place. Calling up the local Air New Guinea office, I'm told by the reservation clerk that my name is nowhere to be seen on the passenger list, Rabaul to Manus Island. Worse still, the passenger list is full. I'm thinking I'd speak with Tony to sort out this, but I'm told he's left the office and can't be contacted. No cell phones, remember. I should just have to hope for the best at 6:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. After all, there's always the jump seat between the pilots. As to the early morning hotel to airport transfer, Tony's assured me that there'll be no problems. I think I've heard that assurance before, and this is Papua New Guinea, and that the airport bus would pick me up sometime between 4 and 5 in the morning. This type of situation, unfortunately, means getting up at just after 3 o'clock to enable a showered and shaved body to be waiting outside the hotel by 4:15, just a little early in case the bus comes early. Obviously, my decade of island experience is coming to the fore here. After 2 frustrating hours standing on the desolate footpath in the dark, with a few worrying, strange movements in the shadows, the bus arrives at 5:45, and I haven't been mugged by the rascals, the name given to the criminal element here in Papua New Guinea. Good news followed us at the airport, with confirmation that I have the last seat on the aircraft on my way to Manus in the Admiralty Islands via Kavieng. Kavieng is the capital town of New Ireland, a province of Papua New Guinea. An attractive, sleepy-looking, flat island covered in palms, little spoilt by the likes of us. The stopover is only long enough to stretch the legs and wish top of the morning to the amicable Irish Catholic priest who's there to meet another of his kind in this fairly desolate but pleasant enough outpost. Not long after takeoff from Kavieng, we fly over the top of New Hanover Island and then finally arrive at Manus, 2 degrees south of the equator. Manus of my day was virtually unknown. However, today it is well known as the remote, controversial Australian detention processing centre, particularly for refugee boat people seeking asylum in Australia. The airstrip for Manus Island is at a place called Momota. In fact, it's a large heavy bomber strip built by the United States Navy Seabees during World War II, complete with Marsden matting on the aircraft landing area and Nissen huts in various states of disrepair alongside its runway. The airport resembles what must have then been part of its former World War II glory. Oh yes, I nearly forgot, the airstrip also doubles as the Admiralty Islands golf course. Although I can't for the life of me imagine who lives here, let alone plays golf. My friend Pat Gillies, back in Port Moresby, maybe. Just a thought. Surely this golf course has to be considered as one of the world's most remote. Momote is on the island of Los Negros and is in fact connected to the main island of Manus by a long, low causeway. Loringau, consisting of, as far as I can determine, 3 shops, 1 post office, 1 terrible pub, no bank, and the all-important provincial government headquarters, and of course, the Air New Guinea office. They're more like a shed. Manus is legally declared a customs port of Papua New Guinea, and my mission, if you're prepared to accept it, Mr. Bond, is to determine why air cargo sent to Manus is showing as unreceived on the arrival manifests. Papua New Guinea customs auditors in Port Moresby raised the issue with Air New Guinea's head office, and my task is to investigate and unravel the issue so that import clearances and duties could once again flow into the government coffers. I remain on the airstrip and watch the passenger bags and commercial air cargo being unloaded. Passengers would then help themselves to their own bags. And then I notice that the commercial cargo is also being removed, but by local businessmen, without it first being taken to the Air New Guinea cargo shed, and then being released upon presentation of the customs clearance release, as should have been the correct situation. Peter Vincent, our Air New Guinea local New Britain area manager, then introduces himself and welcomes me officially to the Admiralty Islands. Peter, like his counterpart in Rabaul, is a very congenial Papua New Guinean. The airport at Momote is some 17 miles from the township of Loringau, my destination on Manus Island. Of taxis and buses, there is none. None to be seen, that is, and very possibly none full stop. The Air New Guinea transport is a small ute with room for the driver, Peter Vincent, and one other. And this is where I, unfortunately, draw the short straw. There's one other Air New Guinea staff member on this flight, and he, unfortunately, outranks me in terms of the airline precedence list. Peter then apologizes for the fact that I'll need to travel sitting on the spare wheel on the back of the ute. But he was not nearly as sorry as I was. After 17 very dusty miles, sitting with a sore chuff on the spare wheel, I think I arrived in town looking like one of those warriors, those mud men that cover themselves in mud in Papua New Guinea. The two biggest problems on Manus are transportation and communication, one of our farthest-flung domestic outports. Total disorganisation. No wonder the correct legal customs process for the receipt of under-bond cargo had gone by the wayside. Lunch at the infamous Loringau Hotel is another story. Not recommended. I get there only after a 2-mile walk in the sweltering midday heat. Mad dogs and Englishmen spring to mind. The company ute has unfortunately returned to Momote Airport. If I had any idea of the distance and quality of the lunch, I'd have gladly gone without. In retrospect, however, I must be fair and state that the day's highlight is when the hotel manager offers to drive me back to the Air New Guinea office after lunch. Maybe he feels for my predicament, especially as a violent tropical downpour started. I spend the afternoon in Manus training our local office staff in the correct procedures and paperwork for all international air cargo arriving in Manus. Cargo having not yet cleared customs is sent from Moresby under transshipment and needed to be identified from the accompanying paperwork, assuming the paperwork has not been lost or misplaced. Quite a common occurrence. Cleared cargo and cargo from other Papua New Guinean origins is, of course, free cargo and can be released against a clean signature. Having sorted out our own office as best I can manage, it's time for me to journey into the offices of the provincial Manus government and to discuss matters of customs clearance with them. Well, I really don't know why I bother. The records of the provincial government are such a mess. Shambles, and they're unable to turn up any documents at all on any of those transactions I'm interested in. So that's it as far as I'm concerned. All that remains is for me to write a report on the matter and remedies taken and forward it to customs headquarters in Moresby, and it's then that I receive some very sound advice from another Air New Guinea manager. He tells me, whatever you do, do not sign putting your name on the report. And that is exactly what I did. Following his recommendation, the matter's closed and never spoken of or communicated on again. Good riddance. The claim to fame of Manus from the Second World War is when its deep water harbour is built by the United States Marine Seabees during the war. This harbour at Lombrum was reputed to be at one stage the biggest United States marine base in the Southern Hemisphere. Bearing in mind that these days, it's fair to say that Manus's greatest claim to fame would now be its Australian detention centre for refugees. Well, it's always good to be home, even in Papua New Guinea. I must tell you about an advertisement that I read in a copy of the Pacific Islands Monthly magazine on the flight back. Most eligible residence for gentlemen's or trader's family. Blended outlook over adjacent cannibal country. The residence is well out of poisoned arrow range and 200 yards out of shot of tower muskets. But tenants possessing magazine rifles can enjoy excellent shooting from their own door. The mansion is thoroughly up to date and is complete with every modern convenience, including bulletproof bedroom shutters, excellent hurricane cellar, good dynamite fishing all around the estate, monthly post and yearly man of war. I wonder who bought it.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio or Apple Podcasts. This free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.